I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
And that is from the conclusion of the 1999 film The Matrix with Keanu Reeves. Hi, my name is Garen Daly. I'm here with Aaron Underwood and Michael R. We are going to engage in a podcast for Boston Sci-Fi Presents entitled Disruptive Films Part 1. And what we're going to be looking at are films like The Matrix, which changed the landscape of films. And Aaron, why don't you tell people a little bit about who you are and what makes you so important and impressive?
I'm Aaron Underwood. I'm the senior event content producer at MIT Technology Review. And I don't know that I'm so important, but I do create the events that MIT Technology Review produces focused on emerging technologies and how they are applied to business, academia, and kind of the world at large. And in my free time, I also plan science fiction conventions such as BosCon, which happens every year in the city of Boston.
And BosCon is one of the oldest. It's even older than we are. So, yeah. You know, that's impressive. And by we, I mean Boston Sci-Fi. and Michael, you're over at Den of Geek, and you have this really delightful attribution of a multimedia content producer. What the heck does that mean?
I might as well just say jack of all trades at Den of Geek. I write a little bit of content for mostly television, actually, but I also produce the podcasts over there at Den of Geek. We have Talking Strange, which is a paranormal podcast, and a Marvel and DC Standum podcast, which is hosted by some of our editors. But I also produce social video and handle some of their social media. So jack of all trades / multimedia producer at Den of Geek.
So let's start off with a really simple, basic question. You know, our premise for Boston Sci-Fi Presents is that we're going to be talking about disruptive films. And when we say disruptive films, we're talking about films that really kind of changed the landscape. Did Matrix change the landscape of films when it came out in 1999?
Well, certainly technology-wise, in terms of how things are filmed in a practical sense versus CGI, it definitely upended things. But I think what's interesting, and including The Matrix especially, is that a lot of these disruptive films that we're going to talk about tonight are not often imitated, or they don't even attempt to imitate them. They just kind of take what was introduced and they spin off of it. Cause I don't think anyone has really done anything like The Matrix since The Matrix. So I definitely think it fits into this category in that sense.
What do you think?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. So with Matrix at that point in time, I think there are a few pivotal shifts in how films are created and made, especially from a technology perspective. And, The Matrix was one of those pivotal shifts where the technology and the filming were so different from what we saw in the past that when audiences saw this on the screen, they were just wowed in a way that they hadn't been wowed in a really long time. And suddenly you see all these other films jumping on board, like, what is this new technology they're using? How did they do that trick? How can we incorporate that into our films? And so suddenly you saw more science fiction films coming out. You saw more films using this cool new technology. And it just changed the way that we were able to tell stories on the screen.
One of the things that I liked about The Matrix is that it was a really dark dystopian film. And I think it hit, not only was the technology there and the, you know, and the bells and the whistles and all the graphics that drew people into it, but it was really kind of dark when you think about, Neo One is really just a copper top. I mean, he's a battery and they're running everything on this. And you kind of wonder, was there a sense of the people viewing it that there was something in the zeitgeist that said to them that they were just this little copper top battery operating in this big, huge universe?
I definitely think it appealed in some ways to people's sense of disillusionment with the powers that be and their place in the world and that sort of thing. And also it was one of the first ones post Star Wars. And we'll talk about Star Wars, I guess, too, but to introduce a sort of a religiosity to the whole aspect of the chosen one and all that kind of thing, prophecies and things like that. And I think people, films, ascribe a lot more importance to it when it gets to that level of cultural depth. Not just in introducing a dystopian world and then putting a superhero in it, because in essence, Neo is a superhero, mm-hmm. but mixing in this chosen one and prophecy and all this makes it that much more majestic, I guess you could say, or self-important. And I think people were like thirsty, very thirsty for someone to lift them out of their own sense of, same thing every day, we're controlled by technology and so on.
Yeah, I think that it's also a really great example of what science fiction does really well. And that's the question of what if, science fiction is known for the question of what if, and then extrapolating from there. What if this isn't our reality? What if we were powering some other, Uber AI robotic realm? What if and so they extrapolate from there, but then they also apply modern social issues, modern politics, modern sensibilities to that answer in order to explore some new ideas. And I think that I think there was also a social turning point when Matrix came out that just really spoke to people, that like, wow, they were feeling something at the time, and this movie answered that call. And it was just a really great example of, if you will, disrupting the way we thought about movies and transforming the movies that came after.
And Michael, when you were talking about Star Wars, it reminded me of the mythology of the Campbell, the hero's journey. And I'm wondering whether Matrix is perhaps a slightly different version of that mythology, and maybe that kind of struck that what you were just talking about, Aaron, that it struck some sort of resonant chord in the zeitgeist. Does that have any validity at all?
It doesn't follow the pattern quite as well as Star Wars, but he definitely has the trials that the hero's journey necessitates.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love Joseph Campbell's story.
We all do. I mean, come on. Yeah. We still see it. Any Disney movie that you see, or any movie, depending on whether the character is Mulan or anybody else, it's always the same thing. The family is divorced, or the family's died, and you got the orphan running around building a new family. Mm-hmm. it's all there.
Well, it's funny because you're qualifying these as disruptive films, and I think I don't know if it takes away from it or if it enhances it in some ways, that people have co-opted the blue pill, red pill idea, made it more political and all kinds of nonsense, where the mainstream media is basically taking the place of these machines that are keeping people asleep and all this stuff. And people want everyone to wake up and see the real world that they're living in, that kind of thing. That's an interesting way that it can be twisted as well. So that's disruptive in a completely different way.
It is disruptive. And you're right. It seems to me that almost every film that is successful, or any cultural piece that is successful, it gets immediately co-opted by whatever side is looking to justify its own existence, whether it's political, whether it's cultural, whether it's social, whatever. And I think maybe that's where the disruptive part comes in, because it ripples through society. And, you know, just to make a transition and a segue, our next film that I wanted to talk about is, you know, Steven Spielberg, who's now everyone's talking about with his Fableman's film, but is Jurassic Park. And here's that clip.
Still gives me chills.
It's a dinosaur.
You're dead. Crazy son of a bitch, you're dead. We get this tear up the rule book on cold-bloodedness. It doesn't apply. They're totally wrong. This is a warm-blooded creature.
This thing doesn't live in a swamp.
This thing's got, what, a 25, 27-foot neck? Brachiosaurus 30.
That is a sense of wonder right there. That
it still holds up. It still holds up really well.
It is a great scene, and I think we all. I mean, there's a sense of wonder there, that you know that is. Sort of, but the thing that I always remember about this film and that scene is when Spielberg talked about it, he made reference to Bruce, and Bruce being the shark from Jaws. And if we remember, we did not see Bruce for about 45 minutes into the film, 50 minutes into the film. And we saw that dinosaur, I think it was 12 minutes into the film. And Spielberg said the audience wouldn't stand for us to be able to hold back longer than 10 to 12 minutes. And that struck me as, what is going on with audiences that allows that to happen, where you can't build up a story? It's always bothered me that, and I've always ended up becoming a little bit more down on audiences for not being smart enough or tolerant enough to enjoy a good movie if they're not getting their satisfaction right away.
That was the counterpoint, I think, initially when that movie came out, is that, oh, here's CGI, they can do anything now. So now how are we going to be able to tell what's real and what's not real? I mean, that was the counterpoint to everyone just being amazed at what they were able to accomplish with that technology, because even the trailer, I remember they did a pretty good job of couching it in the trailer when they were promoting that film, and everyone just couldn't wait to get to the theaters to see the full scene, because they, you know, you could tell just from the 1 foot that showed up in the trailer of that dinosaur that we just saw that it was going to be incredibly impressive. So in that sense, the impatience may have come from not an impatient audience that had been transformed by pop culture and quick bites of entertainment, but also the great publicity for that film that basically made them not want to wait more than 12 minutes to see what they've been waiting for.
I think there's also a lot to be said about that particular comment that really, it was probably the producer and the studio that's like, if you're going to have a dinosaur movie, you need to have the dinosaurs right up front. I think the audience could have waited. I think the audience didn't know what they were going to get. They had no idea what was coming their way. The technology that made those dinosaurs possible had never been shown on screen before to that extent and that depth and with that amount of detail. The audience would have been happy with like a little dinosaur face or whatever. What they got was like Peter Jackson level Lord of the Rings, over the moon. Like they didn't know what they were getting until that dinosaur showed up on stage. And once they saw it, they didn't want to wait another minute to see another one of those images.
You know, Michael, when you were talking, I started thinking, you know, we're talking, you know, when is this? This is 73. I'm wondering if the impact of the trailer on the internet, was the internet out at that time where, I mean, because the internet has changed how trailers have shaped the industry. You know, you can actually almost predict how a film is going to gross and do inside, you know, based on the number of downloads and views. Do you think the trailer was that important for this film? And did the internet have anything to do with it? I don't know the answer to that question.
93 would have been a little early for widespread internet use, but no, I do. I'm speaking of personal experience. In 1993, I was in college and I remember seeing that trailer and I was just could not wait. And, but again, I probably just saw the trailer on TV, not on the internet.
So
trailers wouldn't have been on the internet back then.
Are you a dinosaur geek? I mean, there are people out there that know every single dinosaur that ever existed. And I always wondered, is it because there were big animals that are now extinct and that, you know, we're going towards extinction, or, you know, I just wonder about that. When I'm wandering around in the world and bumping my head into walls. we're gonna go back to Matrix for a second. And here's another clip that, you know, Mark, our director, and Irene, our producer, pulled out. And you know, we can talk a little bit about Matrix. We do think that's a seminal film and disruptive.
Me when he gets shot.
Yeah, he's not quite there yet.
Only human.
Dodge this.
She is something. Love her.
Now that bullet time technology was used more so in like video games and stuff after that movie came out than it was in movies itself. Although there were a couple movies that tried to imitate that. Those cameras lined up. Have you seen the behind the scenes where they've got all the cameras lined up in a big semicircle and they had to shoot it and then composite it together to get that shot?
I haven't seen that. Where was that? Where did you find that? Is that on YouTube?
It's got to be on YouTube.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
When and Matrix came out, I consumed all that stuff.
They have 12 cameras in a circle and they have Keanu standing in the middle doing like, I think he has like a rope on him or one of those strings or whatever, so he can do that bend. But yeah, there are different ways for a film to be disruptive. One is the storytelling itself. One is the filming techniques that are invented, or the cinematography employed. Matrix definitely employs all of those things, but also the very new cutting edge technologies that simply didn't exist before Matrix. Like, they came up with new tech in order to film that scene.
Yeah, they still call it bullet time because it was called bullet time by the producers of the film. And so now anytime anyone uses that technology, they just call it bullet time.
Yeah.
Originating from the Matrix.
You know, when I think of the Matrix and I think of how groundbreaking it is on so many different levels. I mean, you know, the storyline, the background, you know, and now some new stuff you're telling me about the how it was shot. I go, what have the Wachowskis done since then that kind of reaches that same level? And I'm wondering if they're like a sort of the version of the one hit wonder.
I think Matrix 2, 3, 4, no, I'm just kidding.
Well, they're just repeats, really. I mean, you know, there's nothing as original as what they did in the first one.
Well, I think they've done other stories that are just as interesting and engaging, but I don't think that they had pushed their teams to come up with new technology to create a new look and feel or technique in the filming of the movie. I don't think they did anything quite that revolutionary since then.
I can think of one thing, which is not film, but the Wachowskis did Sense8 on Netflix, which was a series was filmed internationally in a way like they literally, so I think this is unique and disruptive in its own way. The way that it was filmed internationally and somehow they matched it together.
Yes.
Like the level of organization and logistics that they would have had to execute to get Sense8 done. It's just mind-boggling.
That's disruptive storytelling for sure.
And it's also disruptive because it kind of takes it out of the Hollywood hands. You know, it's more global. It's you know,
yeah,
it's
very global.
It's everyone in the world, you know, sharing in it, and that is something that Hollywood would not want to do because it's disruptive to their power.
Right, and it disrupted taboo and social norms in some areas. I mean, there were a lot of things and it was a series.
What is love?
All
kinds of stuff. Yeah. What is self? What is the sense of self?
Mm-hmm.
Good point.
Yeah.
Good point.
Great.
Well, you know, when we're talking about disruptive films, you know, everyone seems to think it's always about stuff that's now. And I say, you know, I'm a big silent film fan. And so I go, you know, you look, the first movable camera was before silent, you know, sound ruined the movable camera, the moving camera in many ways. And then, you know, Fritz Lang in 1927 made Metropolis. Take a look at this.
Classic.
I'll confess, I have no idea what's going on in this scene. I know
you
about
the movie,
but what's going on here?
He's creating a woman.
Okay, very, very Frankenstein-esque.
Putting her consciousness into that body.
Gotcha.
Into that robot. That even the filming techniques could get this with the light and the pattern.
I mean,
that
circles
was something back then.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
So you're right, Frankensteinian in its thing. But the other piece that we should remind our viewers of is that Maria and the robot was designed to go out there and control the masses and, you know, to be able to control society. So there's a lot of other things going on there. And the Frankenstein thing is always about, you know, mankind taking science and corrupting it for their own power. So, you know, thinking 1927, that's pretty disruptive for its time. You didn't see that kind of film back then.
Yeah, that's socially disruptive. Absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's built in the build up to fascism and all that.
Well, it's the Weimar Republic. And, you know, it's in my notes we were talking about, you know, the Weimar Republic was the government after World War One in Germany, and it was experiencing hyperinflation. There was a lot of unrest because people were economically deprived. So, you know, controlling in the masses, it really was reflective of exactly what you just said, Michael, the rise to fascism in Germany, which, as we know now, is still something that we have to be very aware of and be conscious of, that it can happen again.
Well, you know, it's also disruptive for the time, the people who were living at that time, was that this movie is like, what, 2.5 hours long in its original form? And people were like, what is that nonsense? We're not going to sit still. Now, of course, it's commonplace to have a 3-hour movie. But back then, it's like, wow. I mean, because dystopian films, first of all, would not have been commonplace, and or science fiction in general, but
actually
to have it that lengthy as well.
Well, that lengthy, yeah. But science fiction in general, I mean, the really first films were all science fiction. The Méliès brothers, you know,
they
were making, that's the all science fiction. It was
the moon with the rocket in its eye, all that stuff.
1914, Frankenstein in the Edison Studios. There's a lot of science fiction that was done back then, but most of it was taken from sources.
Jules Verne and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Because there was a great Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea that they did back, I think, 1918. So science fiction was out there, but this was particular because I think it really presaged, like you were talking about, the fascism rise in Germany at the time and the controlling of the masses with icons, you know? Mm-hmm. So, now we're going to switch to something completely more fun and disruptive in its own way. And that is the 1978 Superman, where we got to see a man fly. And here's that clip.
Right, that's the best part. Yeah.
They're looking at the phone booth, yeah.
Iconic shot right there.
Say, Jim, boom!
Excuse me.
That's a bad outfit.
Boom! Okay, Breslau, I'll move these people.
Everybody's like, oh my gosh, we're gonna fall right now.
God, look up there.
What the hell is that?
Easy, miss. I've got you.
You've got me. Who's got you?
I mean, we're talking about special effects, and I think it was they did a pretty good job with what they had back in the 70s. But you know, Superman has always been an intriguing figure for me. He's not my favorite hero, but I love his source. And you know, his source was, you know, the Siegel and comic books from the 30s, which were all, again, when we're talking about, you know, the rise of fascism in Germany, we also in the U.S. had the Great Depression going on in the 30s. And Superman was a response to give people hope back then, because the regular guys, the regular men and the women, were struggling. You know, we had, 25% unemployment, inflation was tough, and only the rich people were doing well. So, you know, I wonder whether the timing in 1973, post-Vietnam, the kind of malaise that came out of that, the Jimmy Carter era, whether that shaped the fact that Superman became so popular and disruptive in that way. Is that a fair estimation?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, and we've seen it time and time again as film topics, themes, textures, atmospheric feelings, whatever you want to attribute to a film, kind of rise and fall in that sign pattern. Things were really grim and hard and hurtful and bleak. And then you had Superman. Like, that's hope. That's hope in a bottle. That's hope in a flying man. And he swoops in and like lifts everybody up. And that was very disruptive to the time, as well as to the films that followed that. And then you'll notice again, as we go through, like, oh, there's too much happy superhero stuff. Suddenly we get the grim and gritty superhero, the dark Batmans. And so you do see disruptive storytelling come from that angle as well. And I think you can see it best in films, because you do really get that sine wave when you follow the pattern of films that get made and I want to say published, but that's the wrong word. Produced.
Well, I think this movie is, when I saw this was going to be on our list here to discuss, the first thing I thought of was how it disrupted Hollywood's view of whether or not a comic book movie could be commercially viable and popular. Because, you know, prior to this, think of things like, you know, the Batman on TV, which is very goofy, and that people thought the comics could only be, you know, childish and that kind of thing. And of course, you know, George Reeves did have a certain presence in his Superman, but this was something on the big screen and it showed what was possible. And I think it really set the bar pretty high for all the things that came after. And certainly there have been other superhero films since then, especially recently with Marvel's Phase 4, that have not measured up to that standard. And, you know, the original.
That could be a whole nother conversation about what's going on in the Marvel universe, but, you know.
So. Like the story arc and the way that the origin story was told, plus having the relationship with Lois Lane. I mean, and having Lois Lane be an actual presence, an actual person, and not just be some damsel in distress, you know.
A woman in 1973 who had a job and was content to do that without having a guy around. There's also another piece about Superman that he's so square. I mean, he is just so square, and we're coming out of this grim period, but everyone thinks he's cool because he is so square. And I'm wondering whether that, you know, I think part of the appeal, I'm not wondering, but I think part of the appeal is that he hearkened back to that, you know, classic American stereotype of Gary Cooper, you know, the good hero, the good guy. And, you know, no matter what's going to happen, he, you know, he's Sergeant York. He's somebody else. But this time he's just Superman in the dark period in our lives. So
you can always depend on him.
Yeah. There's always times in our history when people are looking for a hero. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it's all about the timing.
Right.
Well, timing is, yeah, and that's a great lead-in for our next one, because 1977, who would have thought that a space opera would actually end up dominating the world and changing? I remember I was like, you know, 27 at the time. I went and saw this film like 8 or 9 times. I think it was the first time I've ever went and saw a film more than 3 times, and it was like 8 or 9 times, and always this closing scene that we're going to show now is just awesome.
I have you now. What?
Yahoo!
Look out.
Yeah, the Death Star. There's another one of your things co-opted, you know, by you know, we now talk, everything is about a Death Star. You know?
I think the thing that gets me about Star Wars in terms of its pioneering and disruptive nature for its time was its use of models, large scale models. And it's not like that was not done before, certainly, but Star Wars was one of these things that was able to combine, you know, those explosions were a little off, for sure, but the way that the camera movements were filmed in a model and then sped up made it ultra realistic for its day. And yeah, I must have watched that movie thousands of times. I had it on VHS and we wore that thing out. And I think I saw the first Star Wars movie when I was 9, which was Empire Strikes Back, but I did have the original VHS of Star Wars, played the heck out of it. But yeah, there just wasn't anything like that. And I do want to say also, Star Wars is the first one that I know of that followed the epic tale story structure, which is start in the middle, in medias res, where you introduce the hero, that the epic story is in progress. And that's why George Lucas, even back then, was promising the prequel series, which no one believed he would ever make, and of course he did.
Yeah,
and it does, and it's very much the Campbell story again, the hero's journey.
Yeah,
there's no doubt about that.
And George Lucas was, Star Wars checks all the boxes. Frankly, it's disruptive in every way possible, from social to technological to storytelling to just what was possible. Like, he sold this film. And at the time that he sold it, it wasn't possible to make it. In order to make that film, he had to invent. He had to pull in the most strange, odd, assorted crew possible in order to conceive of the various technologies and systems and practices to even imagine how parts of that film could be made. And in so doing, he had to found ILM, Industrial Light and Magic.
Yeah.
And in that
didn't he make that just because of Star Wars? Yes. That would have existed without. Yeah, that's what I thought.
He had to create a special effects company that could dream up all this stuff just to make a film that, I mean, by all rights, he shouldn't have been able to sell that film. He shouldn't have been able to make that film, but that man had an imagination and a drive that transformed not just film, but the industry and society all at once. And so when you think about, well, why does everybody care about Star Wars so much now? It's because there really is no other story on our screens that has transformed so many parts of our world, you know, with just one story kernel. And it all came from that one film, from that man's head. So
it's still the same thing that we had with The Matrix too, with mm-hmm. introducing a religious element. It's a faux religion, of course. I mean, it's like, the yeah. prophecy with The Matrix is not really a religion per se, but the prophecy right. element feels like a religion. And having the Jedi in there, I mean, because you have a political structure that people are familiar with. You have the evil overlords and the rebels. That was probably familiar, although even that was very richly created. Mm-hmm. But having the Jedi in there, I mean, that takes it just the way that Obi-Wan Kenobi, mentors Luke Skywalker and tells him to feel the interconnectivity of all living things. Right. I mean, that's very, very Zen.
It is very Zen. But, you know, I tell you, the one of the pieces of Star Wars that I think is perhaps the most disruptive and ultimately destructive is the fact that George Lucas was able to maneuver the industry into giving him sequel rights and marketing rights. And as a result, he became ultimately really, really rich. And everybody else in Hollywood has been trying to emulate that same formula ever since. To be able to, I mean, Hasbro came out with this stuff and all these other companies are selling their stuff and marketing their stuff. And movies became much more of a vehicle for commercialism.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's changed everything. We're now, and even today, when I look at the industry, I look at the fact that the only films that are doing well in the theaters in the post-pandemic period are these big, huge blockbusters. Avatar 2 is going to knock the socks off of box office, but something like She Said is not doing a lot of business because it's a small drama about two women pursuing a evil man, you know? So I think in some ways, disruptive, but it also became destructive. It changed the way that Hollywood operates.
And the franchise idea too, which was with Marvel and Star Wars, yeah. both under the Disney monolith. I mean, that's become something that's just overtaken cinema in general. So yeah, you're right. As disruptive in a good way, the original Star Wars was, it did lead to a lot of bad disruption, including from its own creator. I mean, we were just talking about before the show that scene that we just watched had added an extra little explosion ring to the right. scene. Some of the changes that George Lucas himself made to his own creation were criticized mainly because they were completely unnecessary to enhance an already good film. It's just like, just leave it alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, those are our five films for part one. We're going to be doing part two later on, and then we're going to wrap up this podcast by not telling when we're going to be doing the part two. We'll do it sometime. We'll bring everyone back and we'll discuss some more of these films. But we need to get a little business done. This is being presented by Boston Science Fiction Film Festival. We are hitting the screen at the Somerville Theater and on Filmocracy starting on February 15th and the 20th. Our bookend events, we have the Time Traveler's Ball, which will be a dance thing on opening night, celebrating 60 years of Doctor Who. We're going to have the marathon, which has been going on for 48 years, where 700 or 800 people get and binge view. We wouldn't even call it binge view in the old days because it was just, we were just sitting together. Now we're binge viewing. We ask people to go to our website to find out more. But before we leave, Aaron, is there anything that you would want to, you know, publish or push or shamelessly pimp or, you know, whatever you need to do?
I guess the one thing that I would shamelessly pimp or push is February 17th through 19th. Boston is really the science fiction mecca of the world during that week because they have the film festival. But we also have Boscone, which is New England's longest running science fiction festival happening at the same time, or the end weekend of.
And we love what you do. We do love what you do.
So, and we love what you do too, Garen.
There's mutual admiration there. And Michael, what's going on in your world that needs to be shamelessly pimped?
Well, I already talked about the podcasts, so I'm going to use my plug time to plug the magazine, because Den of Geek has gone into print now quarterly, and the magazines are super collectible, great covers from some great artists. The latest edition of the magazine is a preview of what's coming in 2023. With the cover story for Picard, Star Trek Picard season 3, with some great interviews in there that I think everyone will enjoy. And if you want to subscribe, it's at denofgeek.com/magazine.
Really good people there. And that Picard thing is something that is just reminded me that we're going to have a panel at the Boston Sci-Fi Festival this year, which we're calling The Fabricators. And the property managers, the property masters for Picard and Mandalorian are going to be coming to Boston to talk about how they create all those tchotchkes that you see in those films. So, you know, pick up Den of Geek, the magazine, you know, check out Boscone, and also, you know, make sure you buy tickets for the Boston Science Fiction Festival. I want to thank our staff, Mark Sherwood and director Irene Leite, who is our new producer. You can find this podcast on Spotify, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Garen Daly. I want to thank everyone for being with us today. It really was a lot of fun. Thank you so much. And to give you a sneak preview of our next podcast, here is our closing clip and then our outro.
Oh, no, not now.
Doctor, what is it?
No, not now. I'm busy.
Is it to do with the paintings?
No, this is different. I remember this. Almost remember. Oh, of course. This is where I come in.
Geronimo!
Doctor, wait! Who is this man?